May it please the court. My name is Mark Evans. I'm 40156, a public defender. I'm here today representing Mr. Sean Smith. This case is about whether the district court properly removed from the jury all ability to consider whether Mr. Smith's actions were justified by his need to act in an emergency situation. My intent today is to briefly review the three...
Can I just ask you a question right away? Sorry to jump in, but you said to remove completely, I think, from the jury. Didn't counsel argue in closing that, no, my reason for going in there was not to commit with the intent to commit a crime, but because I wanted to check on the safety of the victim, or the victim, alleged victim, and her children? So he was able to argue that theory of the case, wasn't he?
Your Honor, Mr. Smith was able to argue that he was not guilty of burglary and kidnapping because he did not intend to enter the home to kidnap Ms. Banks, that he intended to assist her. But he was not able to argue that his actions were justified in the affirmative defense sense of the word as to first-degree criminal trespass.
But first-degree criminal trespass requires intent to commit a crime in the dwelling, right?
Your Honor, I believe, at least as the jury was instructed, that it requires an unlawful entry. I think that the intent to commit a crime inside is what differentiates first-degree criminal trespass from burglary.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with you, but okay. Assume for the moment that I'm right. I mean, I know you don't concede that, but just assume that. Wouldn't that take this into the world of Pickering, where we're looking at a difference between an affirmative defense and a traverse? Because if I'm correct that the statute requires intent to commit a crime, then obviously the defendant is not admitting the elements of the crime. The defendant is contesting that element. And so then wouldn't it be merely a element negating defense to argue that my purpose was not to commit a crime, but rather to rescue these people?
Well, Your Honor, I think as the parties acknowledged here, I mean, his intent in going in, I mean, the fact that he was going to assist her and serve a different purpose as to the different charged offenses. I mean, as counsel argued, that's not an affirmative defense under the context of this case to kidnapping and burglary. I mean, that information was provided simply to negate, as you indicated, proof of the various elements of those crimes. But as to first-degree criminal trespass, it was absolutely an affirmative defense because his position was, yes, I entered the home without authorization, but that he was justified in doing so. And that is, I mean, a prototypical affirmative defense.
If you assume that intent to commit a crime therein was not an element of defense.
Your Honor, can I grab the jury instructions from counsel table?
Sure.
In any case, Your Honor, as these crimes were charged, and the instruction that we requested would have... Okay. Sorry, Your Honor. As the jury was instructed, first-degree criminal trespass, defendant in Denver knowingly and unlawfully entered or remained in the dwelling of another. Those are the only elements as they were provided.
As they were charged. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Returning to the three factors under Andrews, which must be shown before the affirmative defense of choice of evils can be submitted to the jury. First, choice of evils defense can be submitted to the jury. The defendant must present some credible evidence. His or her actions were an emergency measure pursued to avoid specific, definite, and imminent injury. Here, the evidence viewed in the light most favorable to Mr. Smith established that a reasonable person in his position would have believed that an injury to either Ms. Banks or her children either had occurred or was about to occur. He knew, at the time he re-entered Ms. Banks' home through a window, that Ms. Banks and her husband engaged in multiple verbal altercations within the last 12 hours, that her husband had threatened to come over that night, and that if he did, there were going to be some problems. She had tried to call him 11 times to between 3:45 and 4:33 in the morning, and that she had not responded to his six calls between 4:57 and 5:55. And finally, that nobody inside of that home was responding to his repeated efforts from the outside of the home, knocking on the windows and the doors and calling out her name to try to summon her from the outside. And that evidence was enough to give rise to a rational inference that Ms. Banks' husband had done exactly what he said he would, and that either she or her children were inside of the home.
Mr. Evans, let me ask you about the prong about alternative means of handling this. Should this have been, what would be shown, what needs to be shown to show that there was an alternative means, or it would have been futile? Because I think the argument your opposing counsel is making is, well, you could have called 911.
That's correct. I think that's a fair assessment of the of opposing counsel's argument. But what Andrews requires is that Mr. Smith pursued not all alternatives, but all viable and reasonable alternatives. And our courts have long recognized that in a medical emergency type of situation, actions which would otherwise be illegal can be justified. Presumptively illegal entries and searches, for instance, can be justified if there's a reasonable basis for believing that an imminent injury needs attending to inside or premises. And the cases discussing those scenarios do not require an absolute exhaustion of all possible options. They simply require doing what's reasonable. And had the facts been as Mr. Smith believed they were, there was a reasonable inference that either Ms. Banks or her children were injured inside of the home. And in that case, that calls for immediate action.
Counsel, was there evidence in the record of a specific threat to the victim here? My understanding was that the threat was to the defendant, that the husband was angry with the defendant. Was there evidence of a specific threat to the victim?
Your Honor, what Ms. Banks testified to was, I told him that Tori, her husband, was going to come over that night, and if he did, there was going to be some problems. So that testimony does not specify whether those problems are going to be directed toward her or toward my client, but Your Honor, I would submit that it doesn't make any difference. And I think that it's important to recognize here that the evidence is undisputed, that before the actions giving rise to this case, these people were in a relationship and presumably cared about one another. And in a situation where if a loved one is in a position where you know that they're in a heated disagreement with someone, you know that that other someone has threatened to come over and that there are going to be problems, and then you try again and again by telephone and by going for the to the home to try to summon that person, that Your Honor, I would submit that most of us in this courtroom would go in and try to render assistance without thinking twice about calling for help from authorities in a situation where there was reason to believe that a medical emergency existed. I would like to point out here that the district court, in ruling on these prongs, I want to go back to the first prong that I discussed regarding the existence of an emergency. The district court stated that those unanswered phone calls and knocks don't necessarily support, they don't reasonably support a conclusion that there was an injury. But that's the wrong analysis. The question was not whether the court thought that there was an injury. The question was whether the evidence viewed in the light most favorable to Mr. Smith would allow a juror to infer that there was an injury. And the court's error was in making that factual finding for itself, rather than simply determining whether there was some credible evidence that if believed by the jury would support the defense. And our Supreme Court has long held that the existence of an affirmative defense is a question for the trier of fact alone. Regarding the prong about causation, whether his entry into the home would have caused abatement of harm, the district court here ruled that there's no showing that's been made in Mr. Smith's alleged actions were pursued to avoid a specific injury. But again, that's also the wrong standard. What the district court was supposed to evaluate under Andrews was whether his actions would have abated the harm, not why he acted as he did. And the question of why he acted was reserved for the jury alone. think I've touched on most of what I wanted to hear. If the court has no further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Well, I do have one quick question. I know that your opposing counsel had stated that the offer of proof in and of itself was insufficient, and I wanted to hear your response to that.
Your Honor, I disagree with the idea that the offer of proof is insufficient. I mean, during that offer, we referenced what had transpired the evening before. This was a short trial. I think that by referencing that, that brings to the court's attention what the evidence was. We stated in the offer of proof that Ms. Banks had asked her brother to stay because she was afraid and that those fears related to her husband. And we referenced alternative measures, such as yelling and banging on the windows of doors. But even if this court believes that that offer of proof in and of itself was not sufficient, this was not a case where this defense came out of the blue. This was discussed before trial. It was discussed immediately after Ms. Banks testified. And at that time, after Ms. Banks testified, the district court indicated that they would have a discussion off the record of the choice of evil's defense. And when you look at the transcript of the jury instruction conference, it's clear that there was a discussion off the record about this defense. So, and this is nothing like Adisa, where the defendant was given multiple opportunities to make an offer of proof and simply didn't. And this was the issue in the case all along.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'll reserve my remaining time.
All right. You have 3 minutes and 55 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. On behalf of the people of the state of Colorado, my name is Michael McMaster, registration number 42368. As our Supreme Court articulated in Andrews, the choice of evil's defense is a misnomer. It does not arise from a genuine choice of different courses of action. Instead, it requires an emergency sufficiently grave that it presents the defendant with no alternative. Specifically, the defendant must make an offer to the court of some credible evidence that if proved would show one, all reasonably potentially viable and reasonable alternative actions were pursued or shown to be futile. Two, the action taken had a direct causal connection with the harm sought to be prevented and would have abated that harm. And three, the action taken was an emergency measure pursued to avoid a specific, definite, and imminent injury. I think if we begin with the third prong here, the defendant was unable to show a specific, definite, and imminent injury. This is what the trial court was referring to when it said that it did, that in responding to the offer, that the defense was simply speculation. Even now, the defendant is unable to articulate which of the three individuals in the harm, or which of the three individuals in the house was harmed, or in what way. Even just now, it's been referred to as a medical emergency. We have no evidence to support that. Had the defendant, had the husband come home and perhaps kidnapped the children, that wouldn't be a medical emergency, but one that might justify the defense. But there are no signs that the husband was home, there was no car in the driveway, there was no broken window, sign of forced entry. There's simply no credible evidence that it proved would have shown a specific, definite, and imminent injury.
Well, Mr. McMaster, I think your opposing counsel was saying, well, the number of phone calls where the girlfriend was trying to contact defendant, and then defendant had returned phone calls that went unanswered, and this was the middle of the night. He's saying that would be enough to show an emergency based on their relationship. What's your response to that?
My response is, even if we assume that that supports the conclusion that there is some injury, it is not a specific, definite, and imminent injury, or potential injury. And that's what's required by the statute and the Andrews test. It's not simply, might she be hurt, but is she hurt, and in what way? And is that, in fact, if it's a potential injury, is it imminent? And the phone calls certainly do not rise to that level. Because there's no injury, the defendant also fails the second prong, because he's unable to show a direct causal relationship to the harm, because there is no harm. It just simply fails on its face. And finally, the third prong, the defendant must show that all potentially viable and reasonable alternative actions were shown, or were pursued, or shown to be futile. As was already mentioned, the obvious answer here is calling 911. And, because we don't know what the potential injury might have been, there's no reason to think that the defendant couldn't have called 911. Certainly something he could have been doing while banging on the doors. And we know from the evidence that he had a cell phone, it was available to him. Instead, it was something that he chose not to pursue. And through that, in that sense, he fails that prong as well.
All right, so what we know from the offer of proof and I guess the evidence presented at trial was other avenues were not pursued. But what is the credible evidence that needs to be shown, I guess, in defendant's offer that would be sufficient? They need to take it a step further to say, I tried, but it didn't work, or what would be sufficient to get the instruction? Do you see what I'm asking?
Well, I think so. Let me know if my answer doesn't quite hit it. Kids show that the alternative actions and the reasonable alternative actions were pursued or shown to be futile. So he doesn't have to show that they were all pursued if he can show that it was futile. So, you know, and this is, we have to speculate here as to, in this type of circumstance, what that would mean. But for instance, if he arrived at the home and it was on fire and he could see someone in the window, so it would be unreasonable to say, don't rescue that person. We don't have that here in this case. And that's why he was not entitled to this instruction. That's why the trial court did not err. Unless there are any other questions.
So I guess I did have a question about, are we confined to looking at the offer of proof, or can we consider the evidence that had been presented at trial thus far in the evaluation?
Your Honor, the short answer is I think the law says you were confined to the offer of proof. And in fact, you know, even in the opening brief, that's the language that's used by the defendant. Pages 18, 19, and 20 have that language repeated in there over and over that you're reviewing the offer of proof. In this case, I don't think it matters. One way or the other, if we look at all of the evidence that was there or simply what was in the offer of proof, in both cases, it's simply inadequate for the defendant to be entitled to the instruction.
Okay.
The people respectfully request that this court affirm the trial court's order and affirm the defendant's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you.
Members of the court, the opposing counsel argues that choice of evils defense requires absolute necessity and that absolutely no alternative be available. But that's not what our law requires. In McKnight, Colorado Supreme Court referenced the defense being available when there is no reasonable alternative other than violation of the law. When we look at Lawson, Salen, and Green, all of which are out-of-state cases cited in the briefs. And those are cases where the court had held that the defense under substantively identical choice of evil statute was required. And you can always go back in retrospect and say, well, couldn't you have done something else? But it's not a question of couldn't you have done something else. It's did you do what was reasonable and viable? When you look at those cases, and even going all the way back to the William Gray, and you see that the defense is allowed when you did what was reasonable and viable at the time.
Well, could you point then to either in the evidence or the offer of proof, the some credible evidence that would meet the prong that other potentially viable and reasonable alternative actions were pursued or were shown to be futile?
Your Honor, the offer of proof did reference specifically alternative actions and did refer to the repeated calls and the knocking on the windows. So I think that those are the alternative actions.
Okay, so if I understand correctly, when he's at the house, the knocking and the yelling at the house?
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think that it's important to remember here that what's reasonable depends upon the context of a given circumstance. And Colorado courts have recognized that when there's the threat of a medical emergency, repeatedly knocking on the door and not receiving any response heightens the exigency of the situation. And that's Chavez, 240 P3rd, 448. So again, what's reasonable depends upon what Mr. Smith was facing at the time. And based on what he was facing, he took the reasonable and viable alternatives.
And I think you said before that it was based on medical concern, that there may be a medical emergency?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Did he have any EMT training or anything?
Did he?
Yes.
That's not in the record one way or the other, Your Honor.
So why would you think it would be more expeditious for him to figure out a way to get in there to break in and to simply immediately call 911 to get an ambulance there because he believes somebody is in injury? Once he gets in the house, he's going to have to do the same thing.
Your Honor,
if the emergency turns out to be there.
Right. Your Honor, even somebody who's not an EMT can render basic first aid. I mean, people know how to stop bleeding. They know how to care for someone. Or, I mean, the other alternative was that there was an assault ongoing in the house. He didn't know at the time. But I mean, it's not as though there was nothing that he could do when he entered the home. I'd like to conclude by saying that the jury in this case really only had two options. I mean, either he went into that house with the intent to kidnap, or he went into that house to render assistance. And viewing the very same evidence as the district court, the jury here did not believe that he intended to kidnap. And the only way to explain the acquittal on the burglary charge with the conviction on the trespass charge is that the jury had a question about whether he was acting to assist. So long as there was a question of fact, it was improper for the district court to remove that from the jury. The jury should have been able to evaluate the affirmative defense. And I respectfully ask this court to reverse Mr. Smith's conviction.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments. The cases stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. That concludes.